Good evening. First, I want to thank Anand and Bob for being here tonight. I know you're all excited to hear from them. A brief introduction of myself to dispel any labels that may be floating out there, as Bob Reich encourages us all to do. My name is Kat Taylor, and I am in service alongside my husband, Tom Steyer, as CEO and co-founder of Beneficial State Bank, a bank designed to change the banking system for good. Metaphorically, our banks are the original and most powerful form of crowdfunding. Not that a specific deposit funds a specific loan, but all deposits fund a lending practice that matters. Think about DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline. Was anyone glad to find out that their bank was funding either that illicit pipeline or the draconian security forces that try to suppress the protesters? We are supporting public banks, a California State Consumer Protection Agency, increased funding for healthy school meals, and reform of the donor advised fund rules in favor of dollars put out the door to the places that need them most. We are political, mouthy, and policy driven. But everyone, each and every one of you, can take back your choice and responsibility for where your money sleeps. As Dr. King told us, political and civil rights, so hard won, will fail their promise without economic fairness. Our efforts in the banking system are just one example of the reform of massive interlocking systems that must occur and occur rapidly to avoid planetary disaster and social chaos. When virtually every sector of the economy and representational democracy are failing, it's time to put more and different people in charge. Frankly, capital has been beating up on labor for centuries, and labor is just people. As more and more of the value created by people through their toil and their participation and their caregiving goes to capital, it will corrupt even more of our decision-making. And we know how badly that went before. This country's own origins in slavery, native genocide, and repression of women, workers, and immigrants were surely driven by immorality, but also fueled by economic self-interest. We can't let that happen anymore. We need a non-violent but radical evolution of our economy. And that which has been designed can be redesigned by all the people. No woman is an island separate unto herself. So our efforts summon the wise keepers of our time and sheer people power, and we have two of them here tonight. I'm going to shock them and you with a short song. Yes, ours is not the first central bank broken. Our eyes are not the first to be deceived. We're not the first to know the bust of CDOs and thieves. You know we're just some fools who are willing to try it one more time with zeal. But baby, can't you see there's only sex tawdry appeal? Yet we're hopelessly devoted to dough. But now there's no way to hide, since we saw beneath the tide our hats in our hands. How could we not then understand? Economy sugar-coated for CEOs. The Treasury says, fools, forget it. The GSEs are hunkering low. How loose can we get before we simply let the biggest banks be hopelessly devoted to dough? But there's nowhere to stand when the wage law of the land bids me against you, paid not to live only to work for some jerks who are hopelessly devoted to dough. But I'll be hopelessly devoted to you. Okay, now we get to the people you actually want to hear from. Gentlemen, indulge me in a little context setting. There are strong indicators of an undermining and unjust economy all around us and for many decades. Some of the usual facts you know include One in three Americans work full-time yet meet the federal definition of poverty. Half of all Americans lack $400 to handle an emergency. For every dollar of wealth white Americans have, blacks have 8 cents and Latinx families 32. 31 million mortgage files showed persistent racial discrimination in lending as recently as 2018, and the biggest banks led by Chase are pouring money into the coal industry, even though it's technically bankrupt. Anand, you write, quote, "In short, America doesn't have a problem of lagging productivity so much as a problem of the gains from productivity being captured by elites. The increasingly extractive financial sector is in part responsible. That sector could be arranged in other ways, including tighter regulations on trading, higher taxes on financiers, stronger labor protections to protect workers from layoffs and pension rating by private equity owners, and incentives favoring job-creating investment over mere speculation." Bob, you have enumerated for all that the causes of these outcomes are the attack on and waning of the labor movement, the rise of monopoly power, the demise of antitrust enforcement, and the pre-preferencing of the wealthy through tax and other regimes. You've also been quoted saying that the only way to grow the economy in a way that benefits the bottom 90% is to change the structure of the economy. At the least, this requires stronger unions and a higher minimum wage. By the mid-1950s, more than a third of all American workers in the private sector were unionized, and the unions demanded and received a fair slice of the American pie. The generosity of the super rich is sometimes proffered as evidence they're contributing as much to the nation's well-being as they did decades ago, but they paid a much larger share of their earnings in taxes. The poor grow in spite of that wealth. And Warren Buffett is famous for saying that GDP has doubled 7 times in his lifetime, but the gains have all gone to him and his kind. We have to add that climate change has been tolerated to feed the greed of the fossil fuel industry, too, at the expense of humanity. There's a bit of the backdrop as we begin. Now, the sting. Bob, you have maintained for some time now that the economic and political systems are rigged in a collusion of politicians and strongman corporations and their associations. How has that happened, and what has resulted, especially for the middle and working classes, since so much inequity since World War II?
How much time do we have?
I'm done.
No, I want to... Well, look, at we're going to talk about all this, but... Much of this has to do with power. And in universities, we don't talk in economics classes and in political science classes nearly enough about power. And over the last 35 years in the United States, there has been a huge power shift to the people who have a great deal of wealth, giving them the power to change the rules, the laws that in turn enhance their power and their wealth even more. So we've had a kind of vicious cycle that has set in. And at the very same time, a lot of those people who are very wealthy and very powerful have seceded from the rest of the population. In fact, being rich today more than not means being in a position not to see anybody who's not rich. And therein lies, I think, one of the real tragedies of the country. And Anand, I'd be very interested in your views of this. I think the Bay Area exemplifies this. We have the most extreme wealth, the most extreme poverty. We talk incessantly about inequality. I don't think any place in America talks more about this problem and exemplifies the problem more than the Bay Area.
It's incredible to me. You know, I think every century or a few hundred years, you have a new power center in the world that rises, a Rome and Athens, that shapes how people are going to live around the world for a long time. And there's no question that that thing in our time is here. Right? This is the place that is inventing the way the world's going to be for a long time. And it is therefore incredibly alarming that it is a place of these divides, of homelessness on the scale that it is, of also staggering elite arrogance. You know, Bob is a serious intellectual. I'm someone who gets in Twitter fights. And
I get in some Twitter
you get in, fights. You get into, I'm not taking that away from you. It's just that that's not the only thing you do. You know, so today I got in a really remarkable one. How many of you saw it by chance? This, I don't want to belabor. Okay.
Do you have injuries? I mean, can you show us what
they're all internal.
When you get, they're internal.
All the bleeding is in my brain and in my heart. This important and influential Silicon Valley investor, Keith Rabois, or Rabois, I don't know how you say it. I don't really, you know. He tweeted this thing about anybody who learns to code has a 0% chance of being homeless in America. You guys like that as the new remedy? Just learn to code, homeless people. Why aren't you taking coding into your own hands? And then, of course, me and several other people on the internet started pointing out all the abundant stories of people who know how to code who are homeless, which exists. And then it became this, it metastasized in this bigger argument in which these people who are the kingpins and queenpins of this new Rome, this new epicenter of power, who truly believe, sincerely, I think, that they're changing the world, they're making the world a better place, that the for-profit tools they're building are emancipatory. Mark Zuckerberg's building a community of mankind. The Google people are going to, you know, just transform cities by making them smart. These same people are monopolists. They have a complete blindness to their own power, to go back to that word you used. You now have a story today about Airbnb essentially being used in China as a platform for discriminating against minority groups in China because half of their listings, a bunch of their listings, have you can't have Uyghurs, you can't have people from here, you can't have people from there. And there's this total blindness in this epicenter of new power here in the Bay Area to the ways in which their story of if only they get richer and their companies get better, the world will be a better place, in fact has distracted them from the fact that they are, in many ways, the biggest problem we have, and they embody an even bigger problem we have. That we have, over the last 30 or 40 years, in the period you have been such a leader on this question, we have been concentrating more and more wealth and power into fewer and fewer hands, while telling an almost opposite story about how the very people doing that grabbing, that hoarding, we're generous, we're changing the world, we're empowering. And just to pick one person, you take Mark Zuckerberg. Who captures that positive story better than Mark Zuckerberg, right? This is not a company, it's a community. I just have a hoodie, I'm so chill. And maybe one of the only companies in American history to possibly tip or certainly distort a federal election result. Because of the arrogance. You're so confident that you're making the world better, that you are so vulnerable, and we become so vulnerable to the ways in which you're making it worse, and then you use the money you made doing that to say you're going to get rid of all the diseases, even though your company is a plague, and all we need for you is to stop being a plague. That's the situation we're in.
Anand, could you talk a little bit more about the fallacy of markets, while they are sort of supposed to tell us everything we're supposed to do, and what is market world? What is that belief system?
I think when a lot of us think about something like extreme inequality or the kinds of power relationships you're talking about, and we imagine, what is it that's upholding this thing? We kind of imagine it's the hard stuff. It's the central banks or the tanks or the laws, these kind of big, hard institutions. And I think so much of this age of extreme inequality is upheld by culture, by values, by beliefs that are simply not true. And at the heart of that in our time is this belief that markets will solve everything. The nice thing about it is we tried it. Right? I was in a debate with this guy, Art, you probably know him, Art Laffer. I told him the laugher laughter curve should maybe be the laughter curve, but you know, and I said to him, I was like, with all respect, the 80s called and they want their ideas back. You're still, you see everything and you say, we should do a tax cut. That's a shame, that problem. Oh, why don't we try a tax cut? They tried it for 40 years, and it was not just tax cuts, it was not just deregulation, it was the idea that everything that happens in the public sphere, all of our common projects, what you write about as the common good, that's all bad. And everything that happens through soloists, everything that happens in the private realm of life, that's good. And that has distorted every part of our culture. This is not just about Washington. It's not just about money and politics. It's about what graduates choose to do with their lives. It's about the fact that 50% of people in the best colleges in the last many years have gone to consulting and finance, which are two micro niche professions even within the business world. And we've ended up with this distortion where the creation of the commons has become this thing that no one really cares about. And I think we are now seeing what happens when you don't respect your commons.
So, Bob, I just want to pose a question, because I know we were all taught Milton Friedman economics, that the fiduciary duty of the corporation is to maximize shareholder value. And yet when you write about the common good, it seems to be the antithesis of what the companies have produced pursuing that for the last 50 years. What should corporations be doing these days?
Well, first of all, there's absolutely no law anywhere that says that corporations have to maximize shareholder value. Before the late 1970s and 1980s, actually, there were a lot of big corporations out there, believe it or not, who not only did not maximize shareholder value, but paid their employees a fair wage. Part of that was unionization, but they didn't fight the unions. And they also were concerned about their communities, where they were founded, where their headquarters was. And they balanced the interest of shareholders with the interests of their workers and their communities. Then came the late 70s and early 1980s, and we saw these people from Wall Street who were basically in the takeover business. They decided that there was money to be made by threatening to take over companies that were so-called, and I love this term, quote-unquote, underperforming. Now, what underperforming means is that those companies were not squeezing every single dollar out that could be squeezed out for their shareholders, and repressing and suppressing wages, and basically leaving their hometowns stranded, leaving rural America stranded, and basically making and creating this mythology that the purpose of the corporation is to maximize shares. The corporate raiders did it. And the next generation of CEOs took over, assuming that that's the way it had to be. Now, they could have, and where I get really pissed off, can I say that?
We're just getting started.
Is that we've got a lot of CEOs out there and a lot of very, very wealthy people in business who will be very influential politically when it comes to changing the rules of the game. By the way, there is no free market. Markets are created by government. Governments enforce rules that are created by government, and anybody who thinks that there's a separate free market in nature out there somewhere doesn't know what they're talking about. But the real point I want to make is that money and the power of CEOs, the power of big money in our society to influence the rules of the game, to go to Washington and make deals and enhance their power, is pretended to be some other kind of activity. When people who are CEOs say, gee, we want to overcome inequality, what they are really saying is we want to preserve a public image that we are good guys trying to overcome inequality, but we're not going to use our influence and our power in Washington and in state capitals to change the laws and change the rules to make inequality less of a presence in our system. We're not going to strengthen unions. We're not going to go to Washington to raise the minimum wage. We're not going to use our influence to do anything that actually helps average workers. We're going to stick to the mythology of the market and the mythology of corporations that are maximizing shareholder returns, and we are going to pretend that we're the good guys. That's what pisses me off.
Can I build on that for a second? That is so profoundly correct, and you know, I end my book by talking to this political philosopher, Chiara Cordelli, at the University of Chicago, who thinks a lot about philanthropy and democracy. And she says this thing that is so staggeringly true. She says, you know, these market people, whether it's operating business people or philanthropists afterwards, have a concept of agency that makes no sense. When you tell them, hey, you can go to Washington and you can get the minimum wage lowered, or you can get your taxes lowered, or you can, you know, get Glass-Steagall repealed. When it's those kind of things, they totally know how to navigate Washington. They love the system. They work at the level of the system. Law, policy, that's how you make real change. When it's restoring Glass-Steagall or raising the minimum wage or increasing a financial regulation, suddenly you hear, you know, the system, it's so complicated. You know, we don't understand how to navigate big systemic change like that. What's the thing we can do now? What's the small doable thing we can do now? And that has led, as you rightly say, to this environment in which you have Ray Dalio, you got David Rubenstein, you got all these people who are the embodiment of our problem, the stinking embodiment of our problem, who have somehow... That was incredible. That was Ray Dalio's spouse or dog or something. But rebranding themselves as the solution to the problem they have been working so hard to cause. And we give them that new brand, right? We buy into, we buy their books. Ray Dalio's got thoughts about the economy. We participate in that, right? And we need to, one of the ways I think this whole thing we're talking about today is upheld is allowing the most guilty protagonists of the age of inequality to miraculously, the arsonists, to miraculously rebrand as firefighters.
So, you've both talked about, sorry, didn't mean to, the problem of monopoly power, and we have experienced this race to the bottom and adverse natural selection and CEOs, so we're now maximizing profit at the expense of everything. But it's now possible to create a monopoly full-blown, a dataopoly, and we have many of them in our midst, that have spawned a gig economy where we're downbidding wages against each other. Business models as swindle as well, hiring low-income people to stiff other low-income people. So what are we to do with the presence of so many natural monopolies and the adverse outcomes that they have created?
Well, I think that the larger picture, again, going back to power, is that you've got big, big corporations, many of them around here, many of them located, headquartered in the Bay Area, that are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, reaching $1 trillion. And the bigger you are, the more, particularly if you're a high-tech firm, the more you can engage in the advantages that come with network monopolies. That is, a network monopoly is a monopoly in which in order to, for anybody to participate and communicate with anybody else, you've got to join that same network. That's what Facebook is. That's what Amazon is. That's what many, in many respects, Google and Alphabet are. And they want to be the networks that everybody has to join. Now, what that means is that there is less and less power elsewhere. Meanwhile, labor has become a pale reflection of what it used to be. Labor unions in the 1950s were over 35% of the American workforce were unionized. Today, in the private sector, fewer than 7% of the workers are unionized. So you've got this big tilting going on in terms of power, a tilt toward monopolies and a tilt away from workers, which is why if you look, if we had a big chart in back, I teach very often with slides. So you'll have to pretend that there's a big slide behind me. And that big slide behind me is a diagram of the American economy. And what you'll see starting in the late 1950s and extending right up till today is that the percentage of the economy that's going to profits, big corporate profits, keeps on growing, and the percentage of the economy going to wages keeps on shrinking. This is not sustainable. It's not sustainable not only morally, but it's not even sustainable economically. Because where is the demand going to come from for all of the wonderful new products and the services that corporate America produces if people don't get paid enough, if there's not enough money in people's pockets? And this is why we've got to get very serious about a guaranteed minimum income. This is why we've got to get very serious about a guaranteed job. Why we've got to, and I'm glad the Democratic candidates are talking about this, get serious about a single-payer healthcare system. A lot of things that really most other countries do, and they don't even think about it. It's part of the way their macro organization of their economy is. And we don't even consider it. We consider it what some of these people are accusing us who are advocating this of being socialists. Socialists? We have socialism for the rich and harsh capitalism for everybody else. That's what's going on.
You know, in your gig economy part of your question, you know, I lived and was a reporter in India for much of the 2000s. My family had come from and emigrated here, and then I decided to cancel out all their hard work in coming to America by moving to the country they worked very hard to get out of. And we all have our own way of betraying our parents. So I was a reporter in India, and, you know, for many people in India who are privileged people, which I certainly was as an expat reporter, the hardship of living in India is a lot of the common systems and infrastructure are terrible. But the countervailing thing is that labor is incredibly cheap. So you just throw a lot of labor at problems. You can have cooks and you can have drivers and you can have this and that. And a lot of people have like many. And I moved back to America, and it was an adjustment to like not having a cook anymore and those kind of things. And then I moved back in 2009. Then a year later, every month there would be like this new startup in America that was bringing Indian-style servitude to the United States, right? You suddenly had Handy bringing people to clean your home at like the drop of a button. Just press a button and someone comes in, cleans your sink, and they're out of your house before you notice, right? And then you had TaskRabbit coming in, literally like name. And I interviewed, I think, Leah Busk, who was the CEO at the time, founder. And she said, you know, isn't there a labor issue, minimum wage? You know, this is not about, she said, this is not about, you know, a job. This is about, you know, like in your neighborhood, you'd like throw a few bucks at a kid. It's sort of like a throwback to that kind of economy, which is a, you know, throw a few bucks at a kid as the new economy. And you have meal delivery, seamless Grubhub. And I think what we don't realize, now that we're several years into this, you got Uber, a lot of Uber drivers in New York are actually under the minimum wage. What we don't realize is we are refeudalizing the economy, using the newest tools in the world, We are refuel. We are moving in an India direction, in a Downton Abbey direction, where New York City, where I live, where I think these trends are similar to here and maybe a little bit ahead of the rest of the country. There are essentially a class of people in New York who are highly paid professionals, and then essentially a delivery cleaning app gig driving class, right? That is not progress. That is using the tools that allegedly are supposed to bring progress as a way to actually return to an economy in which a small number of people have not just money but stability, and everybody else is living in this precarious moment-to-moment existence where they can't see more than 3 inches in front of themselves into the future.
Well, I think we call it the share economy. We're calling it the share economy. I think it's the share the scraps economy.
It's the sharecropper economy.
And I really think that it's part of a larger political and economic and social strategy, which let's call divide and conquer. We have, again, the wealthiest and the most powerful people in this country who are telling the working class that your enemies are the poor, or your enemies, and the reason you're struggling is because of immigrants, or the reason you're struggling is because of black people, or the reason you're struggling is because of somebody else who is maybe trying to share the same scraps you are, and don't look up. Because if you look up, you'll see where the wealth and the power really are. So we would much rather you all battle and go to battle, divide and conquer. And that's what the Republican Party has been doing. It's what some of the corporate Democrats would like to do as well.
So we're going to talk about politics as a solution, but before we leave the realm of business and the economy, I want to posit a solution. That's my job in life. So Marina Gorbis calls this the return of manorial economics, the feudal lord and the serf. And like those times, the serf was limited to a tiny rent off the land that was barely enough to live on. However, probably the more egregious disparity in America is the disparity of wealth. And we do have the means to organize on these large platforms in a way to create a negative network effect, which is the network effect is every member who joins increases the value for those who are in the network. A reverse network is a defection. When Facebook entertained Cambridge Analytica, they almost had a defection. If we use our power of defection, could we not insist for our participation on these networks? And I don't mean people as data, not just your data scrub, but my querying, sharing, shopping, contributing to YouTube, etc., as demanding an equity share on those platforms. That would be called a platform cooperative. Go ahead, have at it, tear it apart. What do you think?
Well, I think demanding an equity share is fine. You can demand as much as you want. I'll go out in the street and make demands after this show. But I think the real trick is to change the laws and change the rules so that those demands actually have teeth. So, for example, just to branch off, Kat, that idea, suppose that companies had to provide not just a minimum wage, but minimum wealth. Mm-hmm. Suppose that companies had to provide workers a certain percentage of the equity of that company. Tiny percentage, but that would grow, that would accumulate, that would have a cumulative impact. That would be real gain and profit sharing in a real world in real time.
Yep.
Well, you'd have to change the law to make that happen, but I'm all in favor of changing the law.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I think is, there was this whole question of, do you boycott Facebook, right? So we got like four people want to do it. And I think it's so tempting, right? And it feels, it's tough because of network effects. There's not other platforms to secretly stalk your high school sweetheart on. And it's tempting and I think it feels exciting, and maybe we could get 100,000 people to do it. Maybe we could get 3 million people to do it. You know, they would still have 2 or 3 billion people on the network. I don't think India is going to get off Facebook. I don't think, you know, the continent of Africa is going to get off Facebook because we're doing a boycott because we're mad about something. And I think we have lost the vocabulary of the law when we think about problems like this. I hear so many people talking about these kinds of individual solutions to something like this. And it doesn't occur to us that Facebook exists at our collective pleasure. Right? It exists because we give it a charter to exist. It's allowed to do the things that it's allowed to do because of an elaborate network of permissions. It's really interesting that there's no Facebooks in a lot of the countries in the world, because apparently their legal systems are not reliable enough for people to start companies like that and grow them in those places. And so we need to actually remember the power of our leverage as a society to say, we have a pretty nice society here and a nice market for you, great users, a lot of money here, trillions and trillions of dollars here. If you want to play here, here are some rules. And get out of this negative frame that we've gotten from the right, that the free market, as you said, is natural, that making money in billions of it is natural, and everything that you do to regulate is a constraint. In fact, we have to start over and say, we have a society here with a bunch of rules. Here's a tax rate. Here's a regulatory framework. Here's what you're allowed to do as a social network. If you don't like our rules, you're totally welcome to not be present in the United States of America. As a wealthy person, as a corporation. I don't think we're patriotic enough on this front. You know, all these people who don't want AOC's 70% marginal tax rate? Totally fine. Let's do it. And if you really don't want to live in America afterwards, don't live in America. I'm willing to play poker with any of those people, because I guarantee you they're still going to live in America afterwards.
So globalization.
If I can just follow that up, Kat, because I think this is important. It turns out that after several Democratic candidates made proposals to raise taxes, and AOC made a proposal to raise taxes the way it, and to the rate it used to be, polls showed, even Fox News showed a poll that showed that most Americans, 70%, 80%, wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy, and even more than half of Republicans wanted to raise taxes on the wealthy.
Including on Warren's wealth tax.
Yeah. And yet, the Republicans, and I know, Kat, you don't want to go quite into politics yet, but I want to just suggest this. We're still told that these ideas, whether it is a Green New Deal that is also extremely popular, or Medicare for all, or raising taxes on the wealthy, we're told over and over again that these are radical, that these are lefty ideas. A majority of Americans want these things. How can they be left when they are supported by a majority? And I think this is really important. The reason that they are considered extreme is not because they are on the left or supported by a majority. The reason they're considered extreme is because they threaten wealth and power in America. And to the people who are controlling many of the levers of power, the middle, what is in the center, is halfway between where most people are and where the power is. That's the center to them. So we shouldn't fall for this, and I hope we get a chance to talk. Here.
Let's go right into it. We'll pause on globalization politics. So this is not the first time we've been in this position. You pointed out, Bob, that the Gilded Age and after the Civil War, the period right before the Depression, we had extreme inequality of wealth and income, and corruption, business corruption interceding in government. We reform, we go back to it. What is the problem? Why can't we stick? FDR's reforms were undone in a matter of 50 years. How does politics be part of the solution, not part of the problem?
Well, I think we've got to organize, mobilize, and take back our government.
And what can we learn from the movements that have tried recently to do that, specifically Occupy? And now, how can we get broad education about the issues of our day, a sense of an economic plan, starting with the Green New Deal, and turnout that would take back our government?
Well, turnout is the key. I think the one perhaps positive legacy of these Trump catastrophic years is that it has inspired a lot of grassroots activity. People are getting in politics who never got in politics before, people are understanding they can't take for granted many of the institutions of our democracy. They have to fight for them. And we've got to fight for a system that actually is responsive to most people. And that is something that a lot of people, as I go around the country, are starting to say, we do have to fight for things we used to take for granted. We do have to fight for our democracy. Well, thank goodness.
My way of answering that same thing is to offer you my stadium theory of history, which is that I think if you look at different eras of American history, the Gilded Age we're in now, the years after FDR, you get presidents, you get leaders because of a moment who actually build an ideological stadium that outlasts them. Right? FDR built one, Reagan built one. And what the stadium is a kind of boundary of conversation within which everybody operates. And there's a left side of the field in the stadium and there's a right side of the field, but they're all playing within the stadium. And so between the 30s and the late 70s, everybody was playing in FDR's stadium, which is how Nixon could create the EPA and which is how Eisenhower could tolerate, you know, high tax rates. And Reagan built a new stadium that was free market fundamentalism, government's bad, business is great. And I think everybody after Reagan, and I think we're still in Reagan's stadium. And it's uncomfortable to say that. And I think the Clinton people don't love that necessarily. And the Obama people might be offended by that. But I think they were all in many ways, many of the arguments that you were involved in. And lost to, you know, people who were investment bankers you had to argue with. Were Democrats trying to figure out how to live in Reagan's stadium. And what makes me hopeful about right now is that people who are as people of Donald Trump's IQ level often have unintended legacies that exceed their intended legacies. And I think what he is doing, I hope, is flamboyantly discrediting not just his own administration, but the age of capital that we've been living in for 40 years. Because he is actually discrediting every thesis of this stadium that we're in. The idea that business people are somehow smarter than everybody else and know more about whatever they want to know about. The idea that making money on a social network makes you educated about schools and how schools should be. You know, the idea that people who cause problems are the leading experts at solving them. The idea that you should just make as much money as possible over here and then with the, you know, blood money of it, heal the problems that you cut. He embodies all of these things, but he didn't create all of these things. And what I hope is happening is that we're at one of those stadium building moments where the next president, if we choose wisely, is not a Democratic president, from my point of view, within the Reagan Stadium, but a stadium builder who is creating the next 40 years of our reality.
I agree. And I think the challenge for the Democrats is to be a Democratic Party instead of a Republican Party. And we can see it, you know, we saw in 2016 the rift between the corporate Democrats, the Wall Street Democrats and corporate Democrats on one side, and in 2016 it was the Bernie Democrats. And I really
hope... Bernie's going to do okay in Berkeley?
I really hope that this time around the Democrats learn that the corporate Democrats and Wall Street Democrats are not going to get the turnout we need to take back the White House.
So isn't a corollary to that that I think there's this idea that I hear said so often on the Democratic side that I think the Republicans are actually much smarter on, which is I think a lot of Democrats say the closer you are to the center, the more addressable votes there are. But I think, you know, if the Republicans understood that was true, Jeb Bush would be president. right? Sometimes the purer, more authentic, exciting, distilled version of an idea actually is more exciting to more people than the watered down, diluted, semi-compromised version of an idea. When Democrats talk about health care and say, okay, so we should do 8 things, you got the block grants, then we should do Medicaid, but there's a, it inspires no one. It may be closer to the other side. It may be closer to the center, but it stirs no one's heart, right? Saying healthcare should be a thing that is provided by the government that you never have to think about again for the rest of your life is a further left position, but it's also an easy to remember, inspiring, emotionally galvanizing idea that regular people can understand. So I think we got to get over this idea that closer to the center means more people. It's not always the case.
It's fewer people. There are fewer people in the center today. And interestingly, at the so-called left, and again, I want to go back to what I said before, because most people are over there. At the so-called left, and even and a lot of people in the so-called right, they really do have some ideals about getting, for example, big money out of politics. Before I published my last book, I was out in the Midwest, and this is before 2016, I was doing research and asking people who they were thinking about voting for. This is in 2015, and I kept on getting back, oh, well, we really like this fellow Trump and Sanders. And I kept saying, well, wait a minute. Which do you like? And they would say, well, we like Trump and we really like Sanders. I said, well, you can't like Trump and you can't like Sanders. And they would say, and these were farmers in Missouri. These were people in Kentucky. These were small business people in North Carolina. I said, you cannot like Trump and Bernie Sanders. That doesn't make sense. And it turned out what they were really saying is, we don't want the game to be rigged anymore. We want somebody who's going to unrig the game and make the game our game. Now, those who voted for Trump didn't know he was a Trojan horse for the big interests, for the big money. But that's what they had in mind. And I think that this is why what you're saying is absolutely right, Anand. If the Democratic candidates really understand the power and force and enthusiasm and energy there is out in America to take back our system, it's not just government, it's our economic system, and make it work for everybody instead of just the few at the top, then the Democrats can create a new arena for the next 50 years.
I was just on the campaign trail covering Bernie Sanders for a Time magazine piece that I'm writing right now. And one of the observations that I in those rallies, I spend about a third of my time watching the candidate, which I start to see over and over, so you get used to that. And I spend most of my time looking at the crowd, right? Which is actually what he's doing, right? What lines are working with them, what are not. And what's so interesting is Bernie's got this whole litany of positions. And on the kind of classic Democratic positions, on abortion or LGBT rights or whatever, there was a certain kind of applause. This is in Iowa and Wisconsin. There was a certain kind of applause. He had many people in the room, but he didn't have everybody. There were clearly some, old white guys in the back who, didn't clap at the LGBT thing or whatever. That's fine. I was paying attention to what are the things that get everybody in the room, right? And it was all the things around corruption, fairness, crony capitalism, money in politics, billionaires running America like a casino where the house always wins and the house is them. That stuff had 100% of the room. That stuff had the old white guys in the back and the kids with purple hair in the front, right? And then you got to the kind of standard issues that we think of as left issues. And it was just smaller. And I think there's a message there. It's exactly what you were hearing in Missouri and elsewhere. There is actually a set of issues around fairness and rich people running America for their own benefit that actually I think are 70 to 80% issues. But it requires someone with the courage to tell that story and to tell it simply and to be willing to not depend on those donors and to actually be willing to be descriptive
about a rigged system that doesn't work for people and not think that that's ideological. Because, I mean, I'm a reporter. I use that word because it grows out of reporting. It is the fact of this country today.
So speaking of that, because there's an argument that you've both made that the Mod Dems are selling us short, colluding with corporate America, and the Republicans and the elite are out of touch and trying to impose solutions on us and stealing the piggy bank. Is it time for a coalition government? Can we ever get this done in a two-party system? The coalition that you just described is a very unlikely one, but it resonates with everybody.
Well, there have been times in American history when third parties do emerge, or strange, different coalitions emerge. Not often, because in a winner-take-all constitutional system, you basically are left with two parties. But we may be inching our way toward that fundamental change in the party structure, because, number one, there is no longer a Republican Party. There's a Trump Party. Trump has basically taken over and created a zombie party that has nothing to do with anything except
Trump. He's basically running it the way he ran all his businesses.
Yeah. A zombie business, now a zombie party. The Democrats are split, as I suggested, between the Wall Street corporate Democrats and the Occupy Bernie, Elizabeth Warren, and so on, Kamala Harris, other Democrats. And the real question is, if the Wall Street corporate Democrats emerge as the winners, now I'm not going to criticize any candidate right now because I don't know where the candidates are going to be, but if they emerge, that creates a vacuum. Politics abhors a vacuum. Remember, there's a zombie Republican Party and there's a corporate Wall Street Democratic Party. That's when you get a third party representing the people.
Great. I want to switch to equity versus equality. So I know it's tempting to think that we had these other eras where things were going well, but honestly, we've left millions of Americans behind and not capable of achieving the American dream, not even capable of keeping their kids safe from a police control state. So it doesn't make sense that we're seeking equality at this point, rather equity. And there are several devices that undermine that, not just corporate America. We've had eminent domain redevelopment, urban renewal, et cetera, at the hands of government. And the legal system that we so cherish has been late to moral decisions and produced some really immoral ones. How can we stand up for equity in everything, in our economy, in our polity, in any ways that we can show up?
Is mine? Okay. I think that the key to your question is the word we. It's all about shifting power. That is, the only way we get to a more decent and equitable society, or a society that really does stand for equal opportunity, is if more people who don't have power gain power and can then change the rules. We can't impose a more equal society. So this is all about movement building. It's about organizing and mobilizing and creating a more powerful movement. It's already begun. I really am very encouraged about what's happening. It's already started, but we've got to enable a coalition of multi-racial, multi-ethnic, multi-class, that is middle class, working class, and poor coalition to come into being and to gain the power they need to change the rules. That's the most important step.
You know, I have moments, and they are fleeting, but moments when the era we're in makes me feel very hopeful. And it's when I remember that Donald Trump is in many ways, to me, a symptom of a disease, not the full disease. He is a boil.
Did you say a boil?
A boil.
A on boil our, on a particular part of somebody's anatomy?
I'm going to leave it to you to figure out which part of the anatomy he's a boil on. But he is a boil on a diseased body politic. And the body politic has been diseased for some time. And a lot of the reason to me we are in this situation is actually that we are attempting something extraordinary as a country right now in these decades that actually no big country has ever really done, maybe in the history of the world, which is as a superpower, sole superpower, become a majority-minority country, become essentially a subset of humanity in this big continent. You know, for all the things I admire about the European safety net, etc., I don't think any country in Europe is going to do that. Before we do, I'm not sure they ever will. I don't think China will ever do it. I don't think India will ever do it. I'm not sure many places ever will. And I think a lot of what is happening, a lot of the resentment that's bubbling up, a lot of these arguments are actually because the fundamental trend line of this country right now, if you're able to rise above the news alerts, is this remarkable experiment we're doing to create like a post-ethnic nation for everybody that is the most powerful country on earth. And I think when we remember that, it actually becomes an exciting enterprise to think about things like reparations, which is so important to do the healing work to get to that exciting place. It's not just about fixing something. It's also about getting to a place where we are building this thing that no one's ever been able to do before. And I think we have to see all of this, whether it's solving climate, whether it's about addressing these issues of equity, whether it's about figuring out how to actually empower women to play all the roles that women play, that we actually don't let it become homework. Let it feel like this annoying stuff we have to do. We actually start to center this as this extraordinary, glorious enterprise of building a kind of country that, frankly, has never existed in the history of the world. Well,
this really touches on something that makes me very optimistic. You know, I've been teaching for 40 years. Hate to admit it.
But you only look 35.
And I had my last class of this particular academic year at Cal yesterday. It was a class of 800 students. And I can tell you that in my 40 years of teaching, I have never come across a generation of students that are more committed to changing the world into a better place than the students I am teaching right now. That's a big, big, big deal.
Thank you. So I want to probe a little bit the idea that we can engage with all these circles of power without being co-opted by them. And I know, Bob, you're a huge fan for civic engagement, civil political discourse, talking to people who don't share your ideas. But isn't there a point at which we both need to harvest the lessons of the insiders and fight with people who are opposing the values that matter to us the most? I know you mentioned one politician who you vehemently disagree with, but you enjoy talking to him, yet he's allowed his state to produce coal at a rate that's cataclysmic to climate. How do you draw the line between civil discourse and co-option?
Well, it's a good question. You're talking about Alan Simpson.
I am.
How did I know? Mm-hmm. Alan Simpson is a dear friend. He is Republican. He's 6'7". We see eye to eye on nothing. But you know what we share? We share a sense of humor, and we laugh a lot together. But when we get serious, it turns out that we have very, very different positions on a lot of issues. We're willing to debate them. We're willing to get to first principles as fast as we can. And then we're willing to stay friends, but understand that we are in different places. Now, that's what we are kind of lacking in this country. We're now in our bubbles. You know, Berkeley is a bubble. It is very hard to persuade you guys of something you don't believe, because I probably believe what you believe. In other words, I find myself increasingly in Berkeley or in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or in other places like that, I'm in places where people are nodding in agreement with what I have to say, and I say to myself in the back of my head, this is the last place you should be. There's no point in being in places where we are all in agreement. What we have to do, all of us here...
They agree with you about that.
What all of us have to do is talk to people outside this bubble who disagree with us and talk to them in a civil way. Start by talking not about labels, not with Trump or with liberals or conservatives or extremism or socialism or capitalism. Start to talk to them about their own personal experiences, their jobs, their wages, their health care, their fears in terms of whether they can afford housing in their community. Talk to them about where they are. Share your own particular stories. Have them share their stories. Share your fears and your hopes. And then, after all of that is on the table, and you're talking about issues of power, because you'll get to that very quickly, then, at the end of all of that, you can talk about, yes, Trump, or capitalism, or the Democrats, if you want to. But it's that building up that foundation that is really important, and that's what we've lost.
Anand, you talked about globalization a little bit, and I just want to get your views on it, both of you. It does tend to lead to lowest common denominator in terms of ecological protections and wages and living standards and so on. But it doesn't, it's sort of can't live with it, can't live without it. Here we are. What is the argument for pushing on not only to better politics in this country, but to some sort of global governance body that would treat world issues as world issues?
I mean, I think globalization is sort of the way Bob described the free market, which is it's a little bit of a false concept in that there's a lot of different types of globalization. And we've treated it as this unitary thing that you either do or you don't do. Right? Who's the biggest winner of globalization in our lifetimes? Probably China, right? A country that jumped onto this thing and used it. The Chinese did it in a very different way than we did. They were much more strategic, and they thought about what they needed, and they didn't do unfettered free trade. They used the hell out of trade, right? But they thought one example of one rule the Chinese have done, which is if you were a foreign company wanting to come into China, you were required to have a local Chinese partner company, right? What did they get at? Every company in the world that wanted to be in China ended up mentoring a generation of Chinese management teams, right? Now, that's not free trade. That's actually a pretty onerous requirement to put on the movement of capital. But it was a brilliant one, right? And they trained millions of people in the best management practices of the world. I don't think we've been smart in that way, particularly when we have the richest country in the world, that, you know, so many institutions from our universities to Silicon Valley that people literally cannot live without. We haven't thought of the same leverage. There is a way to do globalization that's just smarter, that thinks about it strategically, that thinks about, okay, you want your students to come to our universities? That's great. Here's five things we want. Right? We don't do that. And the way Donald Trump has tried to take on this trade thing is through this, like, toddler pissing match. I don't even know what that is. And I have a toddler. I have two toddlers. But I think what we need, we were talking earlier about this call that Larry Summers made after being an unabashed kind of globalization booster. We need to think about also what's a responsible nationalism. What is a way of not having globalization tend to, you know, 8 cents an hour wages and lowest common denominator and kind of servitude on apps, and actually think about a world in which we can take advantage of the amazing technologies of this time, the amazing opportunities to move around and learn from each other as countries, but also not operate in a world in which every company is so optimizing every piece of everything that no one has any loyalty to any community anymore.
Well, let me add to that, if I may, and say that the Trump administration says to China, you cannot have an industrial policy. You can't pick winners. You can't pick losers. You can't really get behind the industries of the future. That's unfair. That's what we used to do. We did it through the Defense Department. We did it through the National Institutes of Health. We did it through a lot of our agencies. And we also did something else. We invested in education. We invested in higher education. We made it so cheap for so many people, starting with the GI Bill and extending for the next 40 years, that by the time somebody was ready to go to college, public universities were almost, and this is including Cal, almost free. Not quite, but almost free. And we invested in infrastructure. The whole interstate highway system was started. You know what the name of the legislation was? It was called the National Defense Highway Act. And we pretended it was all about getting munitions from New York to Los Angeles in the event that the Soviets invaded us.
So we should do the Medicare Defense for All Act.
Exactly.
Slip it in there.
And the Green New Deal Defense Act. And, yeah, just put the word defense in everything. But we don't have the Soviet Union quite there anymore. And, in fact, we may have a president that sort of likes...
We're actually in the Soviet Union now, thanks to this president.
So, but that's my point. When there's hypocrisy there. When we say to China, you can't have an industrial policy, we have one, we did it. There is nothing and should be nothing wrong in the trade rules about building up your economy and building up your workforce.
So the last question I have is actually a request. Manuel Pastor says that all good movements have an economic plan. And Bob, you're famous for saying that we need to educate our youth to understand our economy, who influences, how it has the outcomes it has. Will you both commit here on this stage to helping build out the Green New Deal as an economic plan that we can all be proud of and that will solve climate and injustice for all times?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not sure I have the skills. I feel like there's like better people working on that than me. But here's what I will commit. I think a lot of the reason I can't write policy the way Bob can, but a lot of the reason we are in the moment we're in is because of widely believed bullshit. And what I commit to do is to try to slay the bullshit.
Perfect. So I'm going to end this part with a quote from Anand's book from the Universal House of Justice Baha'i. And while the questions come up to the stage, quote, justice demands universal participation. Thus, while social action may involve the provision of goods and services in some form, its primary concern must be to build capacity within a given population to participate in creating a better world. Social change is not a project that one group of people carries out for the benefit of another. And maybe we can have a round of applause while the questions are coming up. Thanks so much, Bob and Anand. So thank you.
Let me just say, it's been a pleasure, if we don't have a chance to talk after the questions, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you, and I love your book.
And I have loved yours for a long time, so you have many more of them than me.
So thank you, audience. You are a very participatory audience, and we had 50 questions, and we've tried to boil them down to some that capture the category. First question, how do you balance economic justice with economic progress?
You can't have economic progress without economic justice.
The idea that that is a balance is itself a Reagan Stadium idea.
Okay, what is the one thing all of us should be doing, given that we're all going to vote? What additional one thing should we be doing?
Voting is absolutely the minimum. It's necessary. But you've got to organize and mobilize everybody else to get out the vote.
And I'll just add, the word join is really important. Join things. Join things. You know, the internet...
I thought you said joy.
Join.
Okay.
The internet creates a fantasy. I think the internet creates a feeling that we are part of things when we're actually part of nothing.
You spend a day sort of scrolling through Twitter, you feel like you're part of something. You spend a day on Facebook, you feel like you're in some group, WhatsApp chats, whatever. If you haven't barbecued with someone, you're not in a movement with them. If you don't know about their weird leg ailment, you're not in a movement with them. If you don't know the names of their kids, you're not in a movement with them. And I think we need to actually go back to an older understanding that people in the civil rights movement understood, that you can only actually, you're only truly organizing and fighting power when it's actually real physical relationships that people have that form the core of kind of larger action in the world.
I think that's right. And I want to publicly apologize for anything I've written on the internet urging anybody to join an internet petition, because that is not real politics.
Okay. What would be a better and more relevant measure of economic health than gross domestic product?
There are several measures. One measure is the median wage. That is the wage smack in the middle. We tend to look at averages rather than median, and that is wrong. As I've sometimes said, the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 5'11". And that is misleading, always. The averages, because the people at the top bring up the averages. You've got to look to medians. Median wage is really very, very one important. You also have to look to health and public health and how long people and how well people are living. And not just the people at the top, but everybody. We don't really have good health meters. But I know that there are many privileged, so-called privileged students at Cal who are not getting nearly enough to eat. They are actually, many of them are in food poverty. And we, you know, all the way, people around us, we've got to get new metrics. The gross domestic product and the sheer productivity level means less and less and less.
I mean, I think people don't even realize, we hear GDP all the time. I don't think the average person stops to think how absurd it is that the dominant measure of the health of a society is the total value of goods and services sold in a year. Like, if an alien arrived and was like, how do you all measure like how things are? You're like, we just count all the receipts for things that were bought and sold, and we add that up.
Listen, especially because a lot of those receipts would be for guns.
Correct.
For locks on doors.
Correct.
For protection.
For planet-destroying activities.
For all kinds of things that are defensive and negative rather than life-affirming.
So there's a bunch of initiatives. The French had a good initiative which added some great economists to try to add things to GDP. But I think a more exciting question is, like, how would we actually do this if we were starting from scratch? Right? What are the measures of a flourishing community? Mm-hmm. Right? In my second book, The True American, it was about these places in kind of ex-urban Texas, largely white areas, that were being ravaged by meth and all the bad megatrends of a lot of this country. But in GDP terms, those places were still, I don't know, 30-something thousand dollars a year per capita income places, right? By the standards of human history or Steven Pinker's crazy ideas or other countries, those places were doing great. But you look at those places, and they're bleeding out. We need a new measure to capture the poverty of not knowing other people, the poverty of not having community, the poverty of this many people being locked up in jail, the poverty of this many people doing drugs. We don't have very good measures for the actual experiences of people in communities.
Perhaps a good add to the Green New Deal would be new measures. And I'm in favor of throwing out unemployment as some sort of indicator of a good economy, because it's really an indicator of how many people are underpaid. Anand, the phenomenon you write about in Winners is devastating K-12 education. What are your thoughts on this?
Today, there was this extraordinary Twitter thread that I retweeted from this public school teacher, Texas, I think it was, who just told this story. She's an ordinary teacher just trying to care for her kids. And there's no resources. So she goes to the state government. And he meets with a state legislator or someone in the state government. talks about, here's what's happening in my class, here's why we need new funding. And someone who writes state law basically says to her, well, you know, why don't we like create a nonprofit or a charity that we could promote online to like fund these supplies for your kids and fund this and fund that, right? Part of what the billionaire takeover of social change in general and education in particular has done is spread this propagandistic idea that things that are the cornerstone of what a society should do together through common institutions are now better done privately through people kind of throwing coins, whether it's billionaires in education or whether it's GoFundMe, people raising money for their classrooms on donors' shoes. And I think we just have to actually go back to the idea that, you know, if you made a bunch of money in Wall Street, I literally don't care about your thoughts on education. The only way I want you to be part of reforming education is by paying your damn taxes and then letting us, through our common democratic institutions, shape a public education system that works for us. I don't want your name on it. I don't want you on the board of the school. I don't want you telling all your colleagues in the Hamptons that you got three black boys into Yale. I actually want you to get out of the way and allow what is public to be run publicly. I think that's important.
Can I just... This business of paying taxes has to be underscored. Because we've got a lot of very, very wealthy and powerful people and corporations in this country paying little or nothing in taxes. And these are the same people and the same corporations that are going around talking about how much they're doing for the country. J.P. Morgan Chase, for example, and the head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, constantly is talking about a new project, investing in this city, investing in
urban revitalization,
doing all kinds of things. And that bank not only was the lead bank in terms of getting a bailout from the federal government, also is now paying a huge fine, even to the Trump administration Justice Department, for all of the mess it made and all of the fraud. But it's paying almost nothing in taxes, and Jamie Dimon and that bank were in the lead also in getting a huge corporate tax cut and a tax cut for the wealthy from the Trump administration. So all of that talk about bullshit about corporate social responsibility really needs to be understood for what it is. It is bullshit.
And what's so amazing about Chase, some of you may have seen this last week or the week before, y'all see this? That Chase had a tweet from the Chase bank account, part of J.P. Morgan Chase, obviously. And the tweet tried to be cool. And it was basically a dialogue between a bank account and the person whose bank account it was. And the person's saying, like, well, I don't have any money in my bank account. And the bank account is saying to the person, like, don't take a cab, it's only three blocks. Or, like, don't go to Starbucks, like you have coffee maker in your room, and kind of shaming people, like the reason people don't have enough money in their bank account because they're making foolish personal choices. J.P. Morgan Chase is literally one of the main reasons we had a financial crisis that knocked millions of people off their feet. 90% of Americans are still poorer than they were in 2007 because of that crisis. And now your social media account is shaming the people you have hurt for not having money in their account because you made them not have money in that account.
But here's another aspect of power. Because with big money and big corporate power goes the ability to have a huge public relations campaign so that what you are saying and what I'm saying about J.P. Morgan Chase and Jamie Dimon is not known or is not heard or it just kind of disappears in the ether. But people know about these public relations, social responsibility campaigns that are just nothing. They are designed to stop people looking at what's really happening, seeing what's really happening. Smoke screens.
I experience that every day. I will say also, Jamie Dimon just came out in favor of addressing climate change, even though Chase Bank led the nation in fossil fuel financings this past year. So, I would also say that we need to revise philanthropic tax and regulatory law ASAP, too, because we have vast fortunes not doing anything helpful.
If you put your name on a building, you're not making a donation. You're purchasing branding. Okay? That should not get a tax deduction.
Yeah.
If you are using some charitable contribution to be on the board, advise it, then hire your own kids to be, you know, executive director, no tax deduction. You're entertaining yourself. That's fine. You can do that. No tax deduction. If you are truly contributing to the public good, and making our public institutions stronger, maybe we can talk about a tax deduction. Mm-hmm. But we need to move the Overton window on this whole concept that we all should be paying more in taxes to subsidize billionaires making charitable donations and reaping reputational rewards from it.
You know, I could just add to that. The charitable deduction, I think that the notion of charity has to have meaning, and I think this is what you're saying. For example, I think that if a billionaire gives $100 million to Harvard University, I would not make that a charitable donation.
But would you at least allow Jared Kushner to gain admission in exchange?
Yes. Right. That's charity. That's what I call charity. But $100 million...
Is that charity or mercy? I always confuse those.
$100 million to a university that has 30% or 30% of its students Pell Grant eligible, which means from poor families, like University of California, that would be a charitable deduction.
If you haven't read them yet, Winners Take All the Common Good. But also there's a book called A Few Thousand Dollars by Robert Friedman that chronicles how our tax code actually provides $160,000 annual benefit to the 1% and $265 to the poorest Americans at best. Do you think it's time to consider anti-capitalist economic systems in light of the systemic failures that capitalism today currently produces?
Well, I don't know. Once we get into the netherworld of labels, capitalist, anti-capitalist, socialist, I think democratic socialism has a respectable history. And Bernie Sanders, one of his great contributions was to make democratic socialism understandable to some people and respectable and part of our vocabulary. Many young people today who don't remember the Red Scares and the Soviet Union and the McCarthy era and anti-communism, they are very comfortable with socialism. In fact, they are more comfortable, many of them, with socialism than they are with capitalism. Good.
I think the reality is, I think there's this desire on the right to turn this into the Cold War again, where it's a binary choice between communism and capitalism, and a binary choice between a kind of ruthless capitalism or Venezuela. Those are the two choices, and that's it. And I think what no one is honest about when they make it about that binary choice is that whoever wins the presidential election, whichever movement of anybody favoring this room prevails, there's always going to be in this country a large business sector. I think that's the reality. I don't think Bernie has any plan to eliminate private business. There's always going to be government. There's always going to be civil society. All of this is just about the proportions of power that exist in each of these spheres. That's all we're talking about. And it is hugely to the right's advantage to turn this into Stalin versus Jefferson. But this is not about Stalin versus Jefferson. This is about, is it better to have people spending billions of dollars in our elections, or is it better not to? Right? It's actually, a lot of this conversation is about different flavors of capitalism. One of the things we don't realize in this country is that, like, people in Norway actually have quite a bit of capitalism too. It's just different. And we need to get over this American fantasy that we are the only people in the world buying and selling shit in a free market. A lot of people do this. We get a lot of different outcomes. Some are better than ours, some are worse. You just got to borrow things that are, you know, a little better and teach people the things where you're doing them better than them. It's that simple.
Well, the big debate, or another way of saying that, is the big debate that they want us to have is between big government and small government. And the issue is not big or small government. The issue really is who government is for. And we've got to make sure government is for the majority, for the most of us, for the people rather than for those few people at the top that are now controlling it. That is the issue. It's not socialism versus capitalism.
So this is a question for Anand. What do you think critics of your book are missing?
Which ones? I think there's, you know, probably two levels of criticism, if I have to simplify it. I think one that I encounter a lot is a simple defense mechanism that we all have when basic assumptions that we've lived by and have held dear are attacked. I have to say, I've actually been impressed by the number of people for whom that's true who've actually embraced the book despite it pulling out many of the assumptions that have guided their life. But there are some people for whom that's just, it's a lot, right? I mean, in fact, this guy Jason, this VC who I was in this Twitter beef with today, in the middle of the day, he and I were kind of hurling insults at each other, like high-class insults, but still hurling insults. By the end of the day, like an hour ago, he's on chapter 4 of my book. He was somehow inspired to read the book. In chapter 1, he DM'd me how awful it was. And then chapter 4, he publicly tweeted how much he was enjoying it. So I think sometimes the growth between chapter 1 and 4 is like the defenses melt down. But I think there's a deeper criticism that I actually take seriously and try to engage with, which is a lot of what I'm advocating for is the government taking more of a responsibility for our biggest shared problems. And I think even for folks who agree with a lot of my critique, there's just not a lot of faith that that transfer of responsibility would be handled well by the government, that the government is up to the task of doing more things well than it's doing. And I understand that. But I also think, maybe this gets at your question, that a lot of the reason the government doesn't have the capacity it does is because the same people who have been pushing this fantasy of capital have degraded government and underfunded government, and in many ways kind of libeled government for 30 or 40 years, and then are shocked that it's a little bit weak and inefficient and bloated and incapable of things. And I really believe if we actually pivoted from the age of capital to the age of reform, as I was saying earlier, if we don't just turn a little bit, we actually build a new stadium, we actually go into a new age of building common institutions, I think that capacity will come back when you see more and more of us going into government, when you see more graduates excited to go into public service than build an app, when you actually see common purpose become the most exciting thing that you can do with your life, I think government will be able to assume the much greater responsibility of these common problems that right now we're entrusting to billionaire saviors.
You know, some of the noblest callings and professions we have in this country right now are teachers and social workers and people who are government servants, firefighters, police officers, people who are putting themselves on the line every day, doing jobs that are incredibly difficult. They are all government workers. And we don't honor them nearly as much as we should. This business of honoring people that are working for the common good is critically important. And it's critically important in terms of rebuilding.
And by the way, one simple item, people love solutions these days, so I'll give you one. I avoid them in my books, but I'll do it here. I think if you go into one of those professions, your college debt should be wiped out from day one.
Mm-hmm.
Right? a lot of the reason people have to go and do this random stuff, and they tell themselves they want to save Africa, and they go to J.P. Morgan for 10 years, and they collect those bracelets, is, you know, you graduate with a tremendous amount of debt trying to get a good education, and then you one thing leads to another, and you never get out of this private sector track. If we truly believe that these are important professions, whether it's being a public school teacher or a civil servant, you know, I think people who go work at Goldman Sachs, God bless them, but they can pay double in tuition. And people who go become public school teachers, tuition free. Simple.
See, I hear that Green New Deal coming about. Which country is currently pursuing the most equitable economic model?
Well, there are many countries. If you're talking about developed countries, almost any developed country, post-industrial country in Europe or even Japan, even Australia, New Zealand, they're all doing it better than we are. All of them. We are the outlier. Now, this is important for...
So we're number one at being the worst.
We're number...
number one.
We're number one at being the worst in terms of quality of life, wages, job security, all of the things that are harsh about capitalism. We are the worst. And it's not just worst by a small amount. We are way, way out of right field, I should say. And people don't understand that. You know, we could talk about the Nordic countries or anybody else, but the big issue is how weird we are.
And just to build on that, to put that, the way I often think about things is just, what does it mean for individuals living their lives? And I think one of the things we don't realize about us relative to these other countries is, in a lot of these other countries, there's all these things that we spend, as Americans, such a large fraction of our lives stressing about, that they literally never have to think about. They don't have to think about, you know, all these political ads where you see Americans sitting at their kitchen table with bills, like looking at their medical bills, right? This is not a scene that occurs in any of the countries you're talking about. You know, thinking about having to save enormous amounts for retirement is something people just don't have to do in many of these countries. Thinking about having to save hundreds of thousands of dollars for college is just something people don't have to do in many of these countries. And I think something we don't understand as a country that venerates business creation, venerates creating things, what are all the things that are not created in this country every year? Because people are spending their time holding a medical bill instead of dreaming, are sticking to some job they don't like because they can't afford to take their kids off healthcare and therefore don't go start that amazing company? What is all the lost potential of a country that chooses to keep everyone? I'm a very privileged person. I have tremendous justifiable anxiety about my health care every year, my kids' health care every year, and it's shaky. And I'm a very lucky person. What is the collective social cost of keeping so many of us in this perpetual anxiety? And how could we flourish as a society if we took those burdens off of people's mind and let them actually build amazing things?
This might be the last. How can we achieve economic justice in the face of climate disruption?
I like that that's like a lightning round question. I think we should maybe... You got any other lightning round questions?
There's one more. Do you want to hear it?
Well...
Go ahead.
I think we cannot possibly achieve an equitable economy or a society with the kinds of climate change we are experiencing, because it's becoming more and more evident that the people who are best prepared to deal with climate change are privileged people who have insurance. They are living in houses that are sturdy. They're living in places that are less susceptible to flooding. They are people who are not going to bear much of the burden as we slip into more and more climate change. The only thing that I am kind of, and I shouldn't even say this publicly, that I'm kind of hoping for is that when a big chunk of Antarctica falls off Antarctica and raises the ocean levels very rapidly, that Palm Beach county goes first.
Preferably on one of those weekends.
On one of the Mar-a-Lago weekend,
right.
The big Mar-a-Lago
yeah.
weekend.
Yeah. He'd look good on a big ice floe.
There's one more. Aside from increasing taxes on the wealthy, are there laws that can rein in their ability to take the lion's share?
There are so many. I mean, and they're just different versions of the same laws that are allowing them to get away with murder right now. I mean, every law from a minimum wage, which hugely impacts... I mean, people like to pretend these things are complicated. They're not complicated. Every dollar that you're, that Jeff Bezos is taking into his skybox is a dollar that could have been paid as a wage. Right? You can have laws to have things like breaks for workers at Amazon fulfillment centers so that they don't have to urinate in bottles to keep the productivity level up. We can just pass a law that does that, and countries have that. There's a growing important movement in this country for the fair work week. You can't mess around people's schedules with 3 hours notice. You can't, you know, cut 4 hours off of someone's day on Sunday night for Monday because demand is flagging. That's your problem. That's not the worker's problem, right? There's easy laws you can pass. By the way, these are laws that can be passed locally. And one of the shames of our country is that in the places where liberals completely control everything, they haven't passed a lot more merciful stuff, right? New York City, San Francisco, not a lot different for workers in many ways than places like Idaho, right? And so there's a whole bunch of laws that can rebalance what Bob started by talking about, which is power. And we've subscribed to this idea that just leaving business people alone, the heart of the fantasy of everything we've been talking about, is this idea that if you just leave business people alone, all good things will happen. And we, in fairness, let them try it. They tried it, and we saw what we got. And we got great businesses, we got great innovations, with a bunch of good things that happened. But a generation's worth of extraordinary innovation and growth failed to translate into progress for most people if progress means most people's lives getting better. And if we don't change that now, it's going to be changed in ways that are ugly. In ways that we don't choose.
But let me just be very, very clear about the chicken and egg problem that we are facing. Because we're talking about laws that need to be passed. But in order to get those laws passed, we've got to have campaign finance reform. We've got to reverse Citizens United. We've got to make sure that the revolving door between government and business and Wall Street is shut. We've got to actually change our processes so that those laws can be enacted, because the people want them and the special interests and the wealth and the powerful don't have disproportionate power. So how do you get, this is where the chicken and egg comes in, how do you get those kinds of reforms of our democratic process? You get them by organizing and mobilizing. You get them because you make people understand that the most important thing, we can't get anything, we can't do anything about climate change or the minimum wage or anything we want to do unless we take the government back. That's the most important thing, and get big money out of politics.
Yeah. First of all, we need to stop normalizing the criminal behavior of the man in this administration. We should have pushed forward on impeachment, but failing that, we better get out the vote to not have him have a second term. And all the money spent on electoral politics should be going to organizing grassroots movements to get especially the millennial and Gen Z vote out. That's my vote for it, and I would say Tom Steyer agrees with that too. Do you want to take that interview?
I think you beat Donald Trump carefully. And what I mean is I think it's very dangerous to be arrogant about defeating Donald Trump.
You know, and I do sense a lot of arrogance. You know, he's stupid. I'm guilty of this as much as anybody. But Donald Trump is also, in his own way, brilliant, and has fully understood the kind of pressure points of our societies, fully understood where people are feeling a little scared, where they're feeling anxious, the kinds of change that make them unsettled, that threaten their manhood or threaten their whiteness or whatever. And he's figured out simple ideas, the wall, a war with China, trade war with China, simple ideas that anybody can understand that perfectly kind of acupressure those points and give people a certain rush and feeling that he is addressing their deepest anxieties. And what I fear, and this is very early in the campaign, but I fear that Democrats sometimes are so busy on page 18 of their white paper on their fifth policy idea that they don't understand reptile brain politics, and they look down on reptile brain politics. And my simple answer to that is that I think there's nothing wrong with playing reptile brain politics and being simple and being clear, playing to people's fears, even if you're doing it for a good purpose and leading people using that work, leading them to places that will actually make their lives better. And I think the Democratic Party can't be the Harvard Party. That party's not going to defeat Donald Trump.
Let me just say that if we think that Donald Trump is the problem, and that we will be where we want to do just by taking him out of office, we're missing the fundamental story. And that is that Donald Trump is the consequence, the culmination of 40 years of failing to do as a nation what we needed to do. Donald Trump is the embodiment of an economic and political system that has left so many people behind, convinced that it's rigged because it is rigged. If we don't do anything about the rigging, we're going to have Donald Trumps as far as the eye can see. More and more demagogues. Easier and easier for demagogues to come along. You know, I was in the cabinet of a president of the United States in the mid-90s. I began to see what was happening. I spent almost 5 years of my life frustrated and angry, and every day entering that White House and meetings with Democrats who called themselves Democrats but were really representatives of Wall Street and big business and would not allow me or people who believed, I think, in what I believed to do the things that we had to do. Now, I didn't do enough. In fact, I look back on those years and I say, I should have been even a bigger asshole than I was. But my point is...
That's a regret people rarely have. I like that. It's inspiring.
My point is that Donald Trump is not the issue or the problem. It's why Donald Trump was elected to begin with.
I agree with both of those. I think we're out of time. You've been all very gracious to offer your questions and to stay late. I want to give a huge round of applause and thank you to Anand and Bob.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the Bay Area Book Festival. For more information and podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.